You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrat Randy Bryce's congressional campaign recently became the first campaign to unionize its workers. We'll learn more about what campaign work is like and why some staffers are deciding to organize. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Marathon County is developing local regulations for metallic mining, stricter than state laws are now. The state's budget office says $90 million of road funding will be diverted to Foxconn-related projects. And UW-Madison is chiming in on a high school walkout protest planned for later this month. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Well, last year, Rob, Governor Walker signed this bill that ended the mining moratorium, as it was called. It made metallic mining in the state easier. Now we're seeing that local officials in your neck of the woods, Marathon County, might be crafting their own regulations. So what are people talking about there?
Sure. So when the governor signed the law in December, it was by design. The new rules wouldn't take effect until June. And so when that happened, the state senator, Jerry Petruski, who's a Republican from Marathon County, he issued a statement saying that he wanted to make sure that that local governments could use that time to update their own zoning ordinances if they wanted to continue to exclude mining or certain types or put restrictions on mining companies that might want to come into Wisconsin. So this week and in this month, Marathon County has taken up that challenge and is seeking to require some special permitting from any company that would want to mine for metals in the area, and to put some restrictions on where they could go and other sorts of regulations like this.
There was a public hearing about this last night, and here's Marathon County's Corporation Counsel Scott Corbett talking about what the county has the ability to make decisions on.
The county has the power to regulate the operations that are going to occur at the location, plan for economic impacts, plan for impacts on well water, plan for impacts on roads and other infrastructure. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a framework of conditions for mine companies to meet that would address those concerns.
And Rob, this isn't all hypothetical. It sounds like there is a site that potentially could be mined that would be covered under these laws. Can you talk about that?
Right. There's a site sort of east of Wausau in Marathon County that has been under discussion as a gold mining site. And the specifics of it are, it's who knows, right? But there is concrete interest in this site, and a company that has wanted to and pushed for these changes in the past. Had tried to get an exemption from some of the laws. So it's not hypothetical or abstract, but it is a little. It's just very hard to know what sort of impacts we're talking about or what the scale is. There are still a lot of questions, I think, around the proposal.
And what is the timeline for Marathon County potentially putting in these stricter regulations?
Right. So the county is working on a fairly fast timeline. There are county board members who hope to take a vote on this this month. Now, there was a public hearing you played a little bit of sound from that was heavily attended by a bunch of people who are, saying that these regulations didn't go far enough and needed to be more strict still. And so the board decided to take more time with that. So we don't exactly know, but they're going to try to have something passed by the end of March.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. Foxconn remains in the news, Rob, and this week the state legislature's budget office released a memo with an update on transportation funding being used for the Foxconn Technology Plant project in southeastern Wisconsin. What did we learn this week?
Right. So if Foxconn requires new roads, Foxconn gets new roads is what it comes down to. So in the new analysis, the finding is that the state would shift about $90 million in the highway projects away from various other parts of the state in order to direct them to the southeastern part of the state and the Foxconn area to accommodate that massive project.
What have lawmakers said in response to this?
Well, so this is, I mean, you know, we this is not the first time we've talked about Foxconn on this program, and you've talked to plenty of people who have strong feelings on this topic, and it's a polarized issue, right? And you know, you can see the way that that Democrats see this as a vulnerability for Governor Walker, and that the cost, their argument, the cost of the incentives that the state has offered is too high for the benefit that the new plant would bring. Walker's case, you know, is, on Foxconn is one thing. His case on this specific, these diversions, is that by making these changes to the proposed highway project, that's what allows, that's what keeps Wisconsin from having to raise a gas tax. So his argument is that that if we did this the way that, you know, Democrats want it, we would be raising the gas tax and then we would all be paying more. Of course, it can be politically challenging to get credit for something that didn't happen. You know, it's hard to know whether that will, what sort of valence that will have, but that's kind of the shape of the argument now.
Then moving to a national story with echoes here in Wisconsin, on March 14th, a walkout protest is planned for high school students around the country. Students intend to leave class to draw attention to gun control after the mass shooting at a Florida school. UW-Madison has weighed into this, and it's kind of a tangled path to get there. Can you talk us through it, Rob?
Sure. Well, so the students in Florida have been serving as spokespeople for on the issue of gun control and new gun restrictions. And yeah, so the protest is being called the March for Our Lives school walkout. And the idea is that students who feel the same and want to call for these changes should leave school on March 14th and hold an organized protest. Now, if you're a high school student and maybe you're thinking about applying to colleges, you know, and it is true, that most college applications will ask the question, have you ever been suspended from school? And if you walked out of class one day, there is a risk that you might be suspended from school. So, you know, I think that some of the response that has happened from universities has been in response to a concern that, like, parents or, you know, school principals or other authority figures would give young people the impression that if they participate in this, that it would have, you know, huge deleterious effects on their future prospects. And so UW-Madison, Marquette University, Beloit College, Lawrence, a bunch of Wisconsin schools have made public statements to take the time to say to any student who protests this, this will not be held against you in your admissions. You can use your First Amendment rights and participate in a protest without fearing that you'll get in trouble from us for it.
And Rob, before I let you go, I want to touch on another story. There is a cougar making the rounds, and we're always looking for wildlife sightings here on Central Time. Latest sighting, I guess, in Menominee Falls. Can you follow the trail of the cougar?
We love a cougar story, but I mean, it is amazing. Like there are pictures that, you know, these cougars, you know, peering into people's windows and appearing on people's doorsteps. It's a whole thing. The most recent sighting was in Menominee Falls. The DNR thinks this is the same cat that was seen walking up to a Brookfield home and being sighted sort of in that, again, southeastern Wisconsin area. But the cougar could be anywhere. Keep your eye out, I say.
And I understand the DNR thinks it came probably from the nearest known cougar population, placing it in South Dakota?
It seems far away. I mean, I think at this point, this cougar is an immigrant to Wisconsin. Is this cougar really going back to South Dakota? I don't know.
Rob, we'll keep watching for it. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joined us for our weekly roundup of state news. for workers on a political campaign, long hours, low pay, and a lack of benefits are the norm. It can lead to burnout and a high turnover rate from election to election. But a new union is looking to give campaign staff better conditions. Campaign workers for Randy Brice, Democratic challenger to Republican Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st congressional district, recently became the first to unionize. Their decision is shedding some light on a job that usually exists behind the scenes. Meg Riley is the vice president of the newly formed Campaign Workers Guild. Meg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before, Meg, we get to the union side of this, let's talk about campaign work. It feels like political campaigns are going on all the time, but for people who work in it, it's seasonal stop and start kind of work, right?
That's right. It's very cyclical. It's very much a race against the clock, so the urgency is constant. It's very much a go, go, go mentality. So a day in the life of a campaign worker is generally about a 12 or a 14-hour day, and that's 7 days a week. And that is until the day after Election Day. So it's pretty intense.
And I understand that campaign workers are not always well-treated, regardless of political party. They are maybe seen as disposable people that you just work the heck out of.
Yeah, not well-treated is an understatement. They are absolutely exploited. I mean, it makes sense, right? You have a bunch of people on either side of the political spectrum who care so much about a candidate or a cause that they're willing to move across the country, give up spending time with their family, sleep on couches for months. That type of person who's that dedicated can be really easily exploited.
And it sounds like, given how seasonal and stop and start this is, it would be a hard thing to form at least a traditional union for.
And that's part of the reason why this hasn't happened yet, is sort of wrapping your head around what would that even look like. But of course, just because your job is temporary or short or cyclical doesn't mean that you aren't deserving of the same working conditions. So we've been looking at a hiring hall model. We have members who pay more dues when they're working on a campaign and then less when they're not working on a campaign. And when they're not working on a campaign, they will have access to trainings, to job postings, and, of course, the whole community of their fellow campaign workers.
I understand among the protections you're working for is a very timely one, given the news over the last year, an understanding of sexual harassment and what people's protections are.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a funny thing. There's somehow this idea that campaigns are immune to sexual harassment, and that is absolutely could not be further from the truth. In fact, I would say campaigns are even more susceptible to sexual harassment, and that's for a few reasons. The first, which is a really big one, is that people are afraid to speak up because there's this whole culture that says if you do anything to jeopardize the campaign, you truly don't care about the candidate. So people stay quiet about a lot of things, whether that's racism, sexual assault. And then you add that to the fact that there's no central HR system, and it's a really teeny, teeny field, so folks are really afraid of being put on a no-hire list. You sort of have a toxic swill that lends itself to a lot of sexual harassment.
So how, as a guild, do you start to try to organize campaign workers and get them on board?
So before we went public early last month, we sort of targeted campaigns that we thought would be amenable, or largely the campaign workers. So obviously Randy Brice, his campaign workers we knew were very pro-union. We had a contact there, so we went there. But since we've launched, we've had dozens and dozens of campaigns reach out looking to unionize. So right now, we don't really have to go to campaign workers. They're coming to us.
Talking to Meg Riley with the Campaign Workers Guild, the newly formed Campaign Workers Guild, about an effort to unionize campaign workers. Meg, what works differently for a guild of people who work on political campaigns versus a traditional union we might think about?
Sure. Well, first of all, there are a couple changes to a traditional contract. The first is a lot of the timelines. So sexual harassment investigations, for example, they can't take months on a campaign. We can't have this pushed under the rug, as it so often is. So our turnaround time for the moment that someone reports to when a report is due with a proposed action is pretty short on campaigns, first of all.
And what other differences?
Some of the other differences are also to do with sort of the benefits involved. So obviously, right off the bat, I don't think we're going to go from the average of a 100-hour work week to a 40-hour work week. But what we've been doing is getting kind of creative with paid time off, getting creative with the hours and work schedules So on a regular job, you would say it's a Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Here we have to say, all right, it's a 3 to 9 this day, and you don't work Saturdays, but you work in the evenings. You know, we have call time at the end of the day, so folks have to be on the phone calling volunteers. We have campaign events specifically on holidays, like Labor Day parades, Memorial Day parades. So in some ways, everything is flipped, you know. We canvass more on weekends than we work on weekdays, and we work more on holidays than the opposite.
Now, if I'm a political candidate myself, and even if I'm a really nice political candidate, if I'm going to campaign, maybe I'm counting on these workers to selflessly devote themselves to the cause. I might be a little leery about adopting rules that say they can only work so much and so many times, and I have to work around that. Are you worried that candidates themselves aren't going to buy into this?
Well, the beauty of a union is that it doesn't really matter what the bosses think, right? So if we have more than 50% of the worksite who have signed on, and in every case it's been more than that, it's been a supermajority, it doesn't really matter. The workers have unionized. What comes next is bargaining the contract. And in bargaining the contract, workers have a lot of power. First of all, the press that comes with a candidate who is courting a labor endorsement but won't sit down at the bargaining table with their own employees, yeah, that kind of press is not the type of thing a candidate wants.
Generally, in American politics today, Democrats, in some areas anyway, are perceived as more pro-union than Republicans. Does that mean you target Democrats first as you organize?
So far, we have started with the Democratic Party because you're right. I mean, there is an explicit disconnect between the Democratic Party platform and how Democratic candidates have been treating their workers. We obviously, you know, the Republican Party does not have the same platform about unions. We would welcome Republican campaigns unionizing as well. We are nonpartisan as a union. We're for the workers. But yes, we are starting with Democratic candidates for that reason. I mean, it's fine time for them to practice what they preach.
Have you heard from Republican campaign workers saying, yeah, maybe I'd want to get on board with this?
We haven't heard from any yet, but if they reached out, you know, we would go through the same process with them, and we would do the same for independents, Greens, anything.
So we've got a Democratic congressional campaign now organized here in Wisconsin in this 2018 election year. What other kinds of campaigns have signed on and unionized so far?
So I'm glad you asked that question. So we have Jess King in Pennsylvania running for Congress, Chris Wilhelm, who's running for county council in Montgomery County in Maryland, and then 6 minutes before I jumped on the phone, we just finalized another contract with Andy Thorburn, who's running for Congress out in California, which is a huge win for us and for all campaign workers, of course, across the country.
And do you have more in the works where you're in contact with staff hoping to get them on board?
Yes, we have so many in the works that very few of us on the executive council are sleeping right now, so we're bargaining dozens of contracts, and so we're expecting to see a flood of those being announced in the next few weeks as well.
And are you hoping that even if not every campaign unionizes, that you can kind of change the cultural norms of what is expected of a campaign worker?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the end of the day, our goal is that campaign workers get health care, that they don't work for less than minimum wage, that they're not working 100-hour weeks. You know, in some cases, maybe that won't be a union for some places, and that will be, you know, some other form of building power. Maybe in some cities, it'll be like a multi-contract, situation. But I do think already the conversation has changed so much. I mean, from the moment we launched, we got hundreds of people reaching out saying, this is something we've been waiting for decades. So I don't think this movement is going away anytime soon. And we have people reaching out from all across the country and Canada as well, trying to figure out how they can get more involved.
If, say, a younger person comes up to you and says, hey, I'm thinking of going into, political campaigns. I want to get a job. What do you tell them? I mean, given that, you know, they're probably enthusiastic about the politics, they're devoted to it, but it's a rough job. What kind of advice do you have for them?
Well, that's a different question now that we have a union than it would have been, a year ago. That's a tough one. I would say that you have to be really committed to the cause because at the end of the day, you are moving across the country and sleeping on couches, and even if we have great contracts, it's really tough work. I mean, the work itself is really exhausting, and it's skilled labor. A lot of folks seem to think that it's just, something people plug into, but It's a specific skill to be able to cold call someone while they're eating dinner and convince them to knock on doors that weekend on a beautiful Saturday morning. So it's hard. It's really, really hard work. It's not always the most respected, but it's absolutely worth it. Everyone who works on campaigns loves the work. We just want to be respected.
And I know probably the union is part of your answer to this, but how do you suggest people advocate for themselves so that their devotion to whatever the cause of the candidate is isn't taking advantage of?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, is recognizing the power that we have as working people. So the candidates, you know, people talk about volunteers, and volunteers are obviously hugely important, but the actual staff is so important to candidates, and we have that power, and it just takes us as workers to look inside and recognize that if we stand together, we have power. So, again, that doesn't have to be formal unionization. Of course, we're seeing that for the most place, but we aren't just cogs in a machine, and I think we need to break out of that mentality that's what we are, and we're just plugging away forever and ever to get these candidates elected.
Meg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Meg Riley, Vice President of the Campaign Workers Guild. She talked with us about conditions for workers on the campaign trail and the effort to form unions at political campaigns around the country. Now, anti-Semitic incidents increased across the U.S. last year at unprecedented levels. The country saw a 57% increase, the largest one-year increase since records started back in the 1970s, according to the Anti-Defamation League. The organization identified nearly 2,000 examples from 2017, including harassment, vandalism, and assault. Wisconsin also saw an increase, according to the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. Ilana Khan joins us now. She's the director of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. Ilana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
Before we get into some more specific details, can you talk about the trends? I understand that reports of incidents had been going down up until the last couple of years.
Well, we've seen mostly a steady increase over the last few years. But I would say that between 2015 and 2016, we saw a huge jump. And then this year, also a jump, though, you know, not quite as extreme as last year. But so we saw a 30% increase between 2016 and 2017. And I can tell you about the process, because that's, of course,
yes, please,
a question, like, how do you count? But I could, let me just put that aside as I talk about the trends for a second. The trends that we noticed and are concerned about are, number one, I was stunned when I started to really parse the data and saw that what I expected was we see a lot of incidents among middle school and high school students. Accurate, totally accurate. About almost a quarter of incidents are with students on campus, middle school, high school, and college. Second trend was social media. I expected all these things. About a quarter of all incidents happen through social media. Like, that's huge and notable. What I didn't expect was that, and I was actually surprised, which, you know, I've done this for several years, was that the type of incident changed. So whereas we usually have the majority of anti-Semitic incidents are a form of expression. They're sort of general statements. You know, somebody puts a swastika somewhere. Somebody writes on Facebook, you know, Jews are this or Jews are that. But this year we saw an enormous increase, and the percentage was 150% increase in incidents categorized as harassment, threats, and assault. And what typifies those incidents is that they're personal. They're focused on a person or a group of people. They're not a general statement, but they're directed at somebody. So that's what has really surprised us this year. It's a different sort of tenor, a different quality of incidents, if you will.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the incidents that were reported when it comes to that in-person direct harassment?
Sure. So some of it's through letters. It's not in person, but it's, you know, directed against a person. There were the bomb threats at the JCCs. We included those. There were four of them in Milwaukee at the Jewish Community Center in Milwaukee. But there was an 11-year-old child walking home from school when a driver passed by and shouted, "We hate Jews, let's kill them." There was an incident that we, at a middle school in, I was outside the Milwaukee area, actually, a middle school student drew a picture of his teacher and him, and we assume it was him, actually, I'm not sure it was him, and on one of the stick figures, there was a swastika drawn on the kid's forehead, and he was pointing a gun, and there were little signs of bullets coming out of the gun heading toward the teacher who had a Jewish star on her head, and her name was written above. Just in case we didn't know he was talking about his teacher, her name was written above the figure with a Jewish star on her head. That was really disturbing. There was, and that actually, that teacher, there were some, I mean, there were real repercussions because that teacher was afraid. There were swastikas drawn on children's binders in school. So that's different than, you know, a swastika on an elevator. This was like somebody went and said, here's a Jewish girl, and put a swastika on her personal belongings. Someone received five typed letters at her workplace that called her an effing Jewish bitch. I don't know if you beep that, but that's a female dog, yep. And expressing anger at Jews and government. And, of course, the irony was that she wasn't Jewish. But still, there was a call to a CEO of a Jewish organization, a voicemail that I heard, and it said, among other things, the caller said, pack up your bags with all of your other kikes and get the F out of our country. So it goes on. There were just aggressive and sort of, I see it as the unmasking of hatred. It was like, usually it's a little more cloaked. And I really see that, you know, one of the things that was startling when we think about what happened in Charlottesville was that there were people without masks on saying these things that we've grown accustomed to seeing, hearing about with people wearing masks. They were hiding their identities. And that, it feels like the same, feels like a theme. But again, people were unafraid to say, yeah, I believe this.
Talking to Ilana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council about a jump in anti-Semitic incidents across the United States and here in Wisconsin. Ilana, I guess the obvious question is why? Why this change, this more open, personal expression of anti-Semitism?
Well, actually, I do want to say I got a call from somebody, an email from somebody from the Jewish community who said, because we've had a little bit of media coverage when we released the audit, who said, you know, things are really good for us here. So I should say, generally, this is a great time and a great place to be Jewish in this country now. So compared to other periods of history, this is not the worst, and nowhere near the worst. But I think that, I mean, your question is, of course, the question. And we can link the rise in anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidents with the rise of all kinds of incivility, all kinds of bigotry. And we see, it's not only us. We see a rise in racism. We see a rise in hostility directed against Muslims and against immigrants. It's, you know, it's the rising tide of bigotry. I think there's an overall sense of incivility of people feeling like it's truth-telling to say what's on their mind. Rather than to, you know, having a filter is good. Having a filter is good, and then maybe also being in authentic relationships so that you can sort of confront your own biases. And we all have biases. So I think that we're just seeing generally in this country an emboldened and ugliness.
How do you confront that? How do you react to that?
Such a good question. Well, I am so fortunate to work for an organization whose entire purpose is building relationships, understanding that we're all in it together. So sometimes I'm going to call upon my allies and say, I need you to stand with me right now. This is an issue. But sometimes, a lot of the time, it means standing with other communities and other people to say, you know, we're your allies. I see you. I know you. So I get to. There's an entire field of community relations that's all about knowing the other. And we started. There are a few things. We are working right now, I'm trying to get funding, actually, for some special outreach to young people, because we've realized that the way that we reached young people in schools is a little old. Is there a way to reach them about how to confront anti-Semitism, how to confront bigotry, to realize that racism and anti-Semitism are part, they're both expressions of white supremacy, and what can we do to not be bystanders? And also to report those things. How do you identify what is acceptable and what is unacceptable? Because, by the way, a lot of incidents that get reported to us, we say, that is terrible, that person was really being a jerk. But that's not really anti-Semitism. That's just, you know, yucky. So the other thing, so we are working on materials and approaches to reach young people, number one. Number two, we see, I think the conversation about social media is, you know, it's not new. We're not inventing that, but really worth having. What is our responsibility? We have the right to say a lot of things. We also need to ask ourselves what responsibilities we have. And we've seen with the social media companies, like when Twitter banned congressional candidate Paul Nehlen after he's just expressed some awfulness over you know, racism and anti-Semitism, and he finally got booted. We are bringing in a speaker on June 21st who has who's directly confronted this online bigotry, anti-Semitism particularly. He's been called the digital Nazi hunter. His name is Yair Rosenberg. And finally, we have two projects that are proactive, relationship-driven, meaning life happens, the attitudes are formed through one-on-one interactions. So one of them is called Hours Against Hate, and it is a personal call to action that individuals all have the power to confront bigotry and to create a more compassionate community by pledging an hour to somebody who's different than they are, to somebody who doesn't look like them, who doesn't live like them, who doesn't love like them, and who doesn't pray like them. So that's an ongoing initiative, and we have last fall we launched Lunch Hours Against Hate. Most people take a lunch hour. Can we pledge 1 hour a month to knowing people who are different than we are?
We're talking to Ilana Khan right now, director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, talking about a jump in anti-Semitic incidents across the U.S. and in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered these anti-Semitic incidents in the state? Do you see, as our guest does, a rise in bigotry in general against many groups? Why do you think that's happening? What can we do about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. At Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about anti-Semitism with Ilana Khan, director of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Community Relations Council. Numbers up in anti-Semitic reports of anti-Semitic incidents around the nation and in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know experienced anti-Semitism in Wisconsin? Do you think things are worse in the last couple of years than they had been previously? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ilana, we have just a few minutes left. Can you tell us a bit about, you mentioned the method, how you gather these incidents?
So we receive incidents throughout the year. Some of them I get involved in. I'll be in touch with schools and say, hey, you know, this thing happened at your school. Try to hold them accountable, try to help them change the past. So throughout the year, we will be involved in incidents. Sometimes we just receive the incidents and record them. And then at the end of the year, at the beginning of the following year, actually, we have this discernment process. First of all, I look through them and I will knock out those that are obviously not anti-Semitism. And then we have a task force that looks at them, and then we have our board that looks at them, and they will sometimes disagree with each other. And then finally, we have a community council, which is I call it the Parliament of the Jewish Community, because we have seats, we have representatives from all the different, most of the synagogues and organizations have a seat on that body, and they have the last say if something is or isn't. And we are judicious. There is a burden of proof. There are lots of things that don't get included.
I want to bring in a caller briefly. Scott is with us in Wind Lake. Scott, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I was listening, and, I think there was a little segment there where you were talking and mentioning something about, is this something that's more recent or what I was getting at is I do believe, when you take a look at, like, our own governor in the state, you know, he was going after teachers, and he openly said some things that I felt that a leader of the community shouldn't be saying, and I think that, it seems to me that our government officials have, over the years, seemed to become an unmasked with what they say or unfiltered what they say.
Scott, thanks for the call. I want to bring Alana in. What do you look for from political leaders at any level of any party in terms of providing examples and leadership on this in our last minute or so, Alana?
Well, I think it's right. I think that I'm not going to talk about specific examples with the governor, but we saw it a lot with the president, who has said things that are frankly bigoted. So, yes, I think that we need to expect more of our elected officials and our civic leaders. We need to expect more, and I think that it's our responsibility, and we each have power, to contact them and say, you need to do better. Like, this is unacceptable. This is not, I want to admire you. I want you to be a role model. I want you to show me what we can be. So I think that we need to hold them accountable. To be the kind of to help us create the kind of communities we want to create.
And briefly, Alana, we're early in 2018. Are you seeing any signs of improvement?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I've had probably already 10 incidents, but it's hard to discern what's there. We've had some. I'm gonna be optimistic, and I really do think that. People are shocked by the level of discourse in the country, and I think that there is, I think the silver lining is that people are coming together and speaking out and saying this isn't normal and it isn't okay. So I'm optimistic that people will come together and realize all of the isms are linked, and when we allow hatred to flourish, we all lose.
Ilana, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Alana Khan. She's director of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. She joined us to talk about the rise in reported anti-Semitic incidents last year across the country and similar numbers here in Wisconsin. Governor Walker is expected to sign a measure that would make it easier to fill in many acres of smaller wetlands in Wisconsin. Conservation groups are still trying to convince Walker not to approve the Republican-backed legislation and say the bill would just add to several existing threats to wetlands, including threats like climate change. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Over the last two centuries, Wisconsin has already lost nearly 50% of its original 10 million acres of wetlands. The DNR says in southern Wisconsin, the amount gone is well over 75%. An appreciation of the remnants, or what's left, comes across in Pat Truckle's voice as she leads a tour of the Scuppernong Prairie State Natural Area in western Waukesha County.
The prairie drops seed here.
Yeah.
I love this, and then with these little depressions between the prairie drop seed. Have water in them.
Right.
The little clumps of grass known as prairie drop seed are just some of the important plants in this combination prairie and wetland, or what's called a wet mesic prairie. Truckle is a retired DNR biologist. She and current DNR biologist Corey Peters go on to praise the Scuppernong Prairie.
This type of wetland is so unique and so rare.
Remnants like this, they're just not out there. especially in this part of the state with the land use you can see around here.
Their enthusiasm for Scuppernong comes as some say the state is facing a major challenge to a sizable chunk of its wetlands, so-called isolated wetlands not linked to bodies of water and not under federal protections. State lawmakers last week passed a bill that would exempt development of one-acre wetlands in urban areas from a DNR permitting process. Though Senate President Roger Roth said the measure is needed to help business cut through red tape, he also told colleagues the measure would be pro-environment.
Under this bill, we incentivize that development to happen right in your cities, in your villages, so we can protect against urban sprawl.
Roth says farmers and other rural residents would be able to develop up to 3 acres of wetlands, but he adds that both urban and rural developers may have to create other wetlands elsewhere depending on the size of the project. Passage of the bill was not warmly greeted at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association conference late last week in Lake Geneva.
A fairly significant rollback to the protections that we had on the books.
That's Erin O'Brien, Policy Programs Director of the Wetlands Association. She says losing as much as 100,000 acres of small wetlands would be a problem.
These very small areas add up abundantly on the landscape to provide very important protective services to our communities, most importantly, flood storage and reduction of peak flows during severe weather, which of course we're seeing more of lately.
Many scientists say the bouts of severe weather may be linked to climate change. Retired UW-Madison limnology professor John Magnuson is with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. He says he expects more warming and an increase in extreme weather events. Magnuson says wetlands should be able to help during the heavy rain where they still exist.
Most of the wetlands have been eliminated from the Lake Mendota watershed, and so already we've lost some of those protective values in all of those regards.
Climate change may not only increase the need for wetlands to soak up downpours, it could also produce extended droughts. Gary Sullivan is a restoration ecologist with a Chicago nonprofit, the Wetlands Initiative. He says some of the work he does is changing the topography to keep water on site.
So it's losses through evaporation as opposed to drainage. Then you have a much better chance of keeping those wetlands wet. You know, the goal would be to keep them wet long enough for the many different animals that depend on them, especially things like frogs and salamanders to breed in.
Sullivan says some wetlands won't need a makeover overnight. But with a changing climate, he predicts many more will need the help over the next 30 to 50 years. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, from the Black Lives Matter movement to recent pushes for gun control from the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, youth have been at the center of recent protests. We'll look at the history of young people in social change efforts. A new program in Wisconsin provides trained peer coaches to people working to recover from opioid addictions. We'll meet some of the people involved in that effort. That and a look at some of the top news of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday after 7, Kate talks to the former head of the State Elections Commission about his departure, and she talks to a former Republican lawmaker about the next steps for the agency in a big election year. That's Monday morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, President Trump says the U.S. will impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. We'll find out what that can mean for workers, businesses, and consumers, and maybe for Wisconsin cheese exports. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
Robert Kennedy, and I'm representing We Energies. We've had a matching gifts program in place for many years. We match gifts to these organizations between $25 up to $20,000 in a calendar year. It's a great way to engage our employees. They have a say in what we're doing with our charitable giving to make it a better company. I'm Robert Kennedy, and the We Energies Foundation matches our employees' donations to WPR.
To see if your company will match your donation, go to WPR.org/support and click matching gifts.
Wisconsin Public Television would like to thank its viewers for making the first year of Wisconsin PBS Kids 24/7 channel a success.
I'm just going to throw you a party!
Whenever and wherever the children in your life are seeking top-quality, educational, fun television, Wisconsin Public Television is there for you. Watch over-the-air or stream anytime, anywhere at WPT.org.
Way to get down with your bad self!